Welcome. We'll call the meeting of the Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs Finance Committee to order, and the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Gentry.
Here.
Representative Welty.
Here.
Representative Finstad.
Here.
Representative Doty.
Here.
Representative Faust.
Here.
Representative Hamilton.
Here.
Representative Hansen.
Here.
Representative Heidkirchen.
Here.
Representative Magnus. Representative Olin.
Here.
Representative Ochumba. Representative Peterson. Representative Poppy.
Here.
Representative Shemansky.
Here.
Very good. In your folders, you have the minutes, members, from February 28th. Representative Olin moves approval of those minutes. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed. Minutes are adopted. Today, members, we will be looking at the Veterans Affairs budget and the governor's recommendations, if you will. So this is like looking at a bill. This is, and we actually have that bill introduced. I don't have the copies here, Mr. Commissioner, either, but I know you're going to be speaking from that and the recommendations that have been made. I'd also ask, as we go, if you could help us by referring to any budget pages, if you've got those. If you don't, we'll have our pages help you out by giving you a budget book there so you can help us with the pages we need to be on, you know, explain where you're at and as we go, so we can kind of follow along and take notes in our book if we need to, would be very helpful. I guess it's your day and it's your proposed budget, so we're certainly here ready to listen and learn from you, and members ask questions as we go along, I think is the best thing to do rather than wait till the end. We'll interrupt the commissioner as need be here, and I'm sure he's happy to do that. So welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and proceed in any way you see fit.
Thank you, Chair Drunkey. My name is Clark Dyrude. I'm Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And thank you for this opportunity today. We have a PowerPoint which has all our budget change item requests. And Christine Keel, our legislative director, is going to hopefully, if I talk too fast, she'll have a hard time keeping up.
Or she'll slow you down.
She'll slow me down, yeah. One or the other. So we'll try to keep ourselves coordinated here today. You also have a handout of all the slides. So we will just proceed. So the change items for this year, we've broken them down into different program areas. So the first one we want to talk about is our State Soldiers Assistance Program. And that is sort of the grandfather of our organization. This was created in 1944. This is the safety net. This is a safety net that was created by the original legislation that created us. So the State Soldiers Assistance Program, if you move to the slide that says change item, it says that we want to increase funding to by $1 million per year or $2 million for biennium. And this would be a request that would be ongoing from the general fund. Last year, we got an increase, and we are asking for $1 million more. This, is, as I said, has been helping veterans since 1944, and it provides direct or emergent care to the veterans and their families. And we also, with this change item, we can expand something which we call the special needs, which I'll describe in just a moment here.
And members, we're on page 11. No, thank you. We're on page 11 of your budget book. If you want to see it,
yes.
Beyond this, too. So, all right, proceed.
So the current uses for this SSAP, which a State Soldiers Assistance Program, I'll refer to it as SSAP from now forward, the current uses have been for shelter and utilities, optical and dental programs, cash grants for food and personal needs, and educational benefits in the form of a one-time payment to veterans under what's been called the War Orphans Act, which you've already heard some testimony on in a previous committee. The current uses that's been in place, this is the safety net aspect. There is needs-based, it is needs-based is what I meant to say, and it is based on not only the veteran, but the spouse and the children. This makes it unique. The VA, the federal VA, only helps the veteran, but this actually can help the spouses and the children. It helps not only the people that are completely very limited in income, but it helps what's called the working poor. As I say, we have income and net worth guidelines. Moving on to the increased funding, what we asked for last year and got some funding and are back again this year, we have expanded the range somewhat so that we can assist with the cost of mental health counseling, not only for veterans who would get this primarily through the VA, but for family members. They would not have access to anything in the VA. We would also expand it to the special needs program, which we started last year. And this is quite a wonderful program. It, as the name implies, is for special cases. Very often a veteran or the family will not qualify based on income and net worth for the base program. But there are special things that come up one time. Now, the Guard, National Guard, has a family assistance program. They have funding. They can do this for Guard members. But we don't have or did not have anything equivalent in our area. So special needs, we started this last year, and we just gave a list of some of the things it's been used for. I want to emphasize a couple things. First of all, it's a one-time, so this is not an ongoing coming back for assistance. It's a one-time. It is, again, not needs-based in the sense of income and net worth, but needs-based in the sense of a real current need. We've covered mortgage payments to keep while somebody has fallen behind. We have, as you say, appliance breaks. So we have people who are just barely living, you know, budget-wise, paycheck to paycheck, and then they have something that happens. And it has helped not only the new veterans, but also the aging veterans, the World War II veterans and widows. And so this is has been a great boon. I thought it would be interesting to just show you. This is one county's just gave me a chart. So they, thanks to special needs and the increased guidelines for SSAP, you can see the big jump in the usage. Until last year, we had never been able to increase our income and net worth guidelines, and very few people were qualifying. So this has been a great boon last year, and we would like to continue it this year.
Mr. Commissioner,
yes.
Couple of questions I would have. Number one, do we have to do any changing in language in here, or do families and widows and kids and others all qualify for this the way it is set up in statute today? You talk about, you know, for example, would a family of a combat soldier serving in Iraq today, would you be able to go in and, like you say, fix the washing machine when they're gone, one-time money? This person is gone for a year or a year and a half out of the family. They're struggling. The wife calls and says, I can't even afford to fix the washer. Are you allowed to do that today with the language we have in statutes?
Chair Junkie, yes, we can. The example you used, while they're in the Guard would have the program, so this would be the newly created veterans, but it would piggyback very nicely onto that, and the language does exist. The language changes that we have asked for, and we've already come forward, is on the so-called war orphans. We want to open the language on that to the surviving spouse. There is some language changes coming forward on that one. But the main program, the rules are quite open. We set the guidelines, the policies of that, and based on basically the budget.
So you're setting it, Commissioner, in your office. Now, you say it's one-time money. Do you also set a limit to that per person or per incident or per request?
Chair Junkie, we set a limit based on our total budget. For example, we don't want $2 million to go to special needs, obviously. So we watch our dental, optical, subsistence, special needs. So we are watching that the programs in that way. But as far as a single dollar amount, we have shied away from putting any dollar amount so that it has the most.
So it might be $1,000 for one person, $100 for the other. Just depends on the case.
Exactly.
And you haven't had clause where you've had to really limit it at this point. It's fairly benign as far as a dollar.
Exactly. But we are looking at the bigger picture. I mean, we would
not entertain a request for $200,000, for example. I mean, we have that ability and that authority.
And most of these requests come from your county service officers to your office. Is that where you find most of this coming? They're seeking out help in the county. County service officer calls you and makes a request on their behalf, says this is a real deal, we need some help out here. Is that, tell us a little mechanism how it works.
Chair Junkie, that is exactly how it starts. This program is designed to be used by the county veteran service officers. In our department, we don't have a mechanism for someone to walk in the door and apply. So this program is applied for throughout the state by the county veteran service officers. And they have, by the way, it looks very encouraging because we increased so dramatically in year two of the biennium, and we were wondering if there would be, there's always some lag time as people learn the new guidelines, but it appears that the county service officers have stepped to the plate and there is increased usage. I just showed you in passing that one slide. That was just one county, you know. But the county service officers are really, I think, stepping to the plate on this one.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Dyer, maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of us here, but we have these programs, or we're going to be implementing new programs potentially. What are we doing for communication and outreach, whether it's to the tribal community, whether it's to different ethnic groups, whether it's to deep rural Minnesotans, to the veterans that may not know that these special programs exist?
Commissioner Dyer.
Chair Junkie, Representative, we will be addressing that as we go forward. If I could just hold off on that, I will get exactly to that point.
Right.
Thank you.
All right. And again, the dollar amount, I assume you're calculating based on what you see as use coming. You have enough to make it to July 1st this year?
Chair Junkie, to be honest, we don't know. It is a increase last
right
year.
Now, obviously,
projections look like we will get there, but it is new. It's one under the new guidelines. It is less than 1 year old.
And the reason I ask is, Commissioner and members, I mean, if you think it's going to be, we could make some of this money possibly available earlier by language in a bill, and that's why I'm asking if you'd consider those estimates and let us know as we proceed before the next 2 or 3 weeks when we put the bill together. Perhaps we can put language in that some monies are available upon enactment rather than the typical July 1st type time frame. So let us know on that.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. The next area we'll talk about is County Veteran Service Officer Grants to Counties program. It's on page 12 of your budget sheets. And this was a brand new program last year. The idea behind it was to create a sort of a benefits incentives for county service officers. As you know, county service officers are funded 100% by the counties. So there is no central point of authority for a county. Each county is separate and independent. So the idea behind the grant was to provide money for a stated series of purposes, and I will get to that in the one of the following slides. But let's just deal with them in order here, and I can double back and talk about the original grant. The change item asks for an increase of $1.4 million in each year, and there is a one-time $500,000 amount. So the original language that created this last year funded it at the level of $200,000 per year. So it was funded, but not at a very high level. So this asks for a major increase in the funding for the grants. Again, they are open to all 87 counties. Now, the purpose of the grants are to enhance the current services that the CVSOs provide. And in the language of last year, it gives our department the authority to set the guidelines and monitor it. There was a question last year about accountability of any time there are grants. There was a question of accountability. And so our department was given the ability to set the guidelines for the grants based on the language of the law,
and to monitor and to follow up. So we have pretty far-reaching control over the grants, and in fact, total control over whether the grants are properly used or not. So that was built in the language last year. The grants must meet the following guidelines, and this is directly from the language of the law last year. It must expand outreach services, deal with reintegration of returning troops, reduce homelessness within the counties, collaborate with social service agencies, well, and other agencies, and demonstrate measurable outcomes. And the last one was important. It wasn't just an idea of, well, I need some money. You know, I mean, there has to be a measurable outcome. We are going to do something with this money. Here's what it is, and somehow dealing with these areas that were of great concern to, that are of great concern to the legislature. So in the first year we had, we just completed the grant cycle, and with very short order, 39 counties applied, and there was over $600,000 was requested. And, of course, we only have $200,000 to grant. Now, 19 counties received funding. There were too many counties. Many of them were very, very excellent, and there's just so much money to go around. And I should expand that about $100,000 of this is to be split up among over 40 counties who are going to Fort McCoy. They're physically traveling to Fort McCoy when the soldiers are reintegrating. They're coming back 300 at a day, and it will be about a five-week period. There will, every day, there will be at least two, if not three, county service officers there working with people from our department, from the VA, from obviously the military. But since these soldiers are still in the military, they are ordered to come through and visit and get information about their benefits. So the county service officers are really stepping to the plate, and much of this money, disbursed your money, is going for travel and to cover the costs of travel for them.
Commissioner, is that the extra $500? Is that what that's for, the travel? Do you have a dollar amount, what that 40-county travel commitment is or what it will cost?
Chair Drunkie, that is $100,000 of a $200,000 grant. So
from last year,
$100,000 is for travel, and then the remaining 19 counties had $100,000 split up.
So, Commissioner, did they actually apply for travel grants, or is this something you offered as a department to assist with? Without the you said there's 39 grant applications, and I'm trying to figure out, and perhaps you can provide us with some additional information, exactly what those applications were for, and then what you awarded monies to them for, as we try and discover what the money's used for and why it's out there.
Chair Drunkie, about the middle of that slide, it says three joint county applications. One of those joint county applications was for the $100,000. There was a lead county, the treasurer for their own organization was the lead county on that application. But there are 45 counties, I don't have the exact number, over 40 counties were listed on that grant for $100,000 for travel. And so they will, that came forward from their association. The county service officers have been very much involved in planning the reintegration of the county, of the soldiers coming back.
Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Dyrud, what was the criteria for getting a grant?
Commissioner, criteria for getting one of these county grants?
Chair Drunkie, Representative Tremba, if you look on the previous slide, it says grant requests must meet the following guidelines. Expand outreach services, the reintegration, I won't read them again. So we had, this was a brand new process. We had, as I say, 34 different counties applied, and there was a lot of good ideas, and there's only $100,000 after the $100,000 for travel. There was $100,000, 34 counties applying for that amount of money. So it was very difficult. I mean, there were just decisions that made, let's say it was very difficult. We had a committee looking at the applications, and choices had to be made. And there was a limited amount of money, basically $100,000. So what we tried to do was grant the ones that most fulfilled those guidelines listed on, I don't know, yes, on that, according to the law.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are you going to evaluate the grants now that they've been implemented? I understood that this was something that they did as an evaluation and not what they did in writing their grants. So that's why it doesn't seem clear that there's a follow-up, because it's easy to write a grant that looks great, but if you don't follow through with it, or if you've got a great grant writer, it looks better than somebody who maybe is going to even do a better job, but they don't have the $10,000 whatever that volunteers to do that in the community. So I understood that this was after, but how are we going to follow up to make sure that the grants that went out to the counties actually did them?
Commissioner Dyrum.
Chair Drunke, Representative Otremba, if you notice, the last bullet on that slide says demonstrate measurable outcomes. We are asking for a midterm update on how the money was spent, and there is a final report. And again, there has to be measurable outcomes. Let us say that someone wants to use it for transportation. That would be an easy one, because they would say, we want to transport 100 veterans in the coming year. Well, that would be relatively easy, the final report. They either transported or they didn't, increase their transportation. But there is a quick example and a simple example of measurable outcomes. A lot of county service officers are using this for outreach, for PSAs, for spots on radio, TV, true advertising. But again, there are results. They have to do a mid grant cycle report and an end grant cycle. So you are correct, Representative. Initially, if there's a good grant writer, I suppose they could request something, but they do have to report how they have used it. And we have the authority to look at that and follow that and keep tracking that.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are the names of the counties available and the kind of grants that they wrote available so that we could see?
And Representative Otremba, that's exactly, if the commissioner, if you or your staff could provide, if you have it today, great, we'll get copies made. If you don't, I guess we're interested in the counties that applied, what they applied for, and then what they were granted. I think we have you're dealing with mostly rural members here, except for Representative Hansen, God bless him, who's sitting here from the metro area. But, of course, we've got our rural eyes on, and we understand the limits of a lot of our rural counties with resources. And I think that's what some of us are getting at. We'd like to see, is Hennepin and Ramsey getting the bulk of these, or is it going out to our, Todd County and our smaller counties that really have limited resources and struggle to keep these offices funded and moving the way that we need them to out there. And so I think some additional information on this would be very helpful as we consider the requests here in the next few weeks.
Chair Drunke, we do have a list right here of the 19 counties and the dollar amount they requested or that they were granted.
Was it 19 or 39? Your next slide. So
39 put in, but only 19 were granted. McLeod, Clearwater, Marshall, Winona, Kandy, Ohio, Wilkin, Freeborn, Norman, Chippewa, Wabasha, Renville, Houston, Le Sueur, Anoka, Scott, Olmsted, and Cook. And then Nicollet as an agent for two or three counties, and then Goodhue was a fiscal agent for the 40 or the 45. I don't know the exact number.
If you want to give that to a page, we'll get copies for the committee. And then as follow-up, if you could make a list of what they applied for. Was it travel? Was it, what were the applications made for, so we can get an idea of what our county service officers are asking for assistance in? I think it would be helpful.
Yes. Chair Junkie, we can certainly do that.
Good. And we'll get that to members hopefully as soon as you guys get it to us. So. Please continue. Wait a minute. Representative Heigerkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, my question, the Commissioner refers to the reintegration monies that you had referred to before. I know the governor's initiative, someplace I saw within the Military Affairs Division, of there was an appropriation of $1.5 million tied into the Beyond the Yellow Ribbons. I don't know if you're familiar with that initiative or not. But I know that within the federal government also right now that they have appropriated a certain amount, and I'm not sure exactly how much money was appropriated on the federal side. In what way does the state, what way does your department look at spending the money in what fashion?
Commissioner Dyer.
Chair Junkie, Representative Heigerkin, Military Affairs is actually tracking a bill in that area. This year, I think, as you know, we were separate. We normally would, in the past, have gone before the same committee. This year, Veterans Affairs was moved. Military Affairs is still under government ops. They are going forward with information. Yes, there was a federal one-time grant given to the state of Minnesota for reintegration. It is being administered by Military Affairs. They also do have a request, and I don't have the details, but that is under Military Affairs.
Okay. Proceed.
The next area would be page 16 in your budget pages, and this comes under the general area of communication and outreach. And our change items there, we are requesting an increased funding $2 million in each year, $4 million for the biennium, for communication and outreach. And it breaks down, we'll be talking about each one separately. The request would be ongoing from the general fund, $750,000 per year for tribal veteran service officers, $1 million per year for Minnesota Assistance Council for veterans, and $250,000 per year for Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs statewide marketing and outreach. I would like to now talk about each one separately. And the first area would be the tribal veteran service officers. We have a major problem with veterans benefits that are universal across the country. And you've, I think, heard me give this statistic before, and this underlies our whole presentation. Only about 40%, or actually less, of veterans actually apply for the benefits that they qualify for. That is simply an ongoing problem. And it seems that the more combat a veteran has seen, the less apt they are to come out, identify themselves, and apply for anything. So there is that is just a problem that has been around forever. So part of the whole county veteran service officer system, part of our reason for being, is to try to reach out to veterans. So outreach could in one way be sort of the heart and soul of this whole veterans program. So now we do have a county veteran service officer system in Minnesota, and Minnesota is only one of 26 states that have that. So there's a lot of states that don't even have a county veteran service officer. So now when you look at that, and they are reaching out in their own areas, but in Minnesota we have several Indian reservations. Seven of them are in north of here. And the Native Americans have an unusually high percentage of volunteers for military. Statistics say anywhere from 25% to 30% of adult male Native Americans volunteer for military service. And when they volunteer, they don't volunteer just to be in the service. They volunteer for combat units, special forces, you name it. So they have a very high rate of veterans in their community. They come back, and the problems that I just talked about are exacerbated. This is a totally made-up percentage, but it would be way less than 30 or 40%. I mean, I don't know, pick a number, 10%, 5%. You have the problems that veterans are faced, and it's exacerbated, living on a reservation. They will not come forward, identify themselves, or in this case, leave reservations and go to a different town, a state, a federal building, whatever. So what we are doing, we were approached by people from several of the tribes. And this has been an ongoing discussion. And what we are proposing is that tribal service officers, and $750,000 per year would provide 7 or 8 FTEs, with a one northern supervisor. We also would have a person in the metro area, because we have a claims and outreach office, but there's a high number of Native Americans in the metro area. So we are aware of that. We would be serving there. We would have tribal service officers on the northern reservations. There'd be a supervisor up in the north. Again, the details would be dependent on the amount of funding, because also what is not set is part of the funding would go for transportation of not only the veterans, but the service officers. There is a need for ongoing training, and there's a lot of travel involved for the tribal service officers, but also for the veterans themselves. And that transportation, and the county service officers know this well, transportation doesn't involve just traveling to a VA. It involves getting veterans to actually come in and get treatment, even in their local communities. So when we're talking about traveling, transporting veterans, it is a very wide-ranging problem. So we have some funding for positions and funding for travel. There would be in kind from the tribes. The Indian Affairs Council is aware of this. They are approving of this, and they would provide office space on the respective tribes. The metro area would be housed in our office out at Fort Snelling. So we are prepared to cover both metro and outstate areas.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Dyrud, you rattled through the statistics rather quickly as far as the number of Native Americans that enlist in service and in combat, mm-hmm. and then how the issues are basically compounded when individuals return back home and not apply into any of these programs of the like. And so I guess my question is, and maybe you addressed this and I missed it, when you're talking about the service officers and having an office to address this and to where veterans can come in and understand what the programs are, you mentioned St. Paul. Are we looking at putting an office up north where the majority of these people do reside?
Mr. Dyrud.
Chair Junkie, Representative Hamilton. Yes, there would be. That was either 7 or 8. There are 7 northern tribes, and there would be a tribal service officer on Fighter, Red Lake, Leech Lake, the northern tribes. There would be. We would work in unison with the tribal councils from each tribe to get someone locally involved in the reservations. But we also would have a person, starting with at least one in the metro area, who would start working with the Native American community in Minneapolis, St. Paul, the suburbs, wherever necessary.
Representative Hamilton.
Oh, okay, just follow up. So right now, these service officers up north, they're non-existent. Is that accurate?
Chair Junkie, Representative Hamilton, that's correct.
Okay, and so in this proposal, we would have the 7 to 8 FTEs, and this is also in the governor's proposal. That's correct?
Chair Junkie, Representative Hamilton, that is correct.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since I have to speak for the metro area as the lone voice here, I have to shoulder all of that. I applaud you putting a position in the metro area. I think that Hennepin County, Minneapolis, very large population portion with tribal members. Plus, I think it's an opportunity for Minnesota to lead. We have a lot of folks that move around the country, and tribes work with each other, and Minneapolis is kind of a focal point where folks meet and greet. And I think it's very important with these positions to go to where people are, rather than have people come to you. And so by putting positions on the reservations, but also working with the community where they may reside or where they're traveling, I think is very important. So to speak for the metro area, I think it's just good to to see that, and I think it's a good initiative, and I applaud you for doing that.
And, Commissioner, I think it'd be helpful if we could see actually where these offices are going to be initially. You say 7 or 8 with one supervisor, some follow-up on that. I know the Shakopee and that area are supportive. A lot of our friends have met with a lot of us in our office already on this, and obviously the more well-to-do tribes or reservation areas that are maybe associated with casino revenues or others are not looking for this help because they've got it handled. Yet I know a lot of our less income tribes are looking for this, and I think it'd be helpful if we could kind of get a location near city or which tribe, which reservation, where these are going would help us to look at it also. And I think the other important thing, which I think you should explain to us, is how you will monitor this. I think you expressed it well. We really have no idea on the numbers of people out there until our service officers perhaps get out there, start working with these populations. But I would hope, and I think you will concur, that there will be some flexibility in this. I mean, if we're there for a year or two in a location, understand there maybe isn't the population of need yet. In the Twin Cities, we see an overwhelming response, and word of mouth is getting out, and people are starting to come forth, realizing, again, a lot of the Native Americans in the Twin Cities and around the state are not necessarily associated with the Minnesota tribe. They might have moved in from some other part of the country or wherever it's at. And so, you know, having tribal offices on reservations is one thing, but that isn't the whole population. So can you talk a little bit about the flexibility and trying to understand where these services are needed and how you'll address that?
Thank you. Yes, Chair. There are, the reason it says 7 or 8 FTEs is exactly the kind of points you're raising. For example, Grand Portage is a quite a small reservation, but it's very remote in terms of distance. So we have to work with that. Do you put 0.5 FTE? Do you have someone cover 2 reservations, but there's great travel involved? Those are the things that we are wrestling with behind the scenes if we are fortunate enough to go forward with this legislation. So we definitely have at core reporting. In other words, people contacted, people transported. That's the heart and soul of it. If there are no claims coming forward, if there is no work with the population, obviously that would be looked at. That is ongoing reporting. And I think the whole issue of metro versus rural county service officers, today we have, I know the Ramsey County Service Officer is sitting in the audience here today, and I know that the president of the county service officers, Steve Stone from Peace River Falls, is in the audience, and we have several other service officers in the audience as well. But the rural service officers are much more involved with things like transportation than the metro. The metro have sheer numbers. And so part of this outreach is the county service officers, Hennepin, Ramsey, have X number of staff. They can't just increase their staff and do a lot of outreach traveling within the community. They do a marvelous job, but this is, this outreach would, as the name implies, be out in the community. And so there are different methods of operation, if you will, in a rural county as opposed to a metro county. And that's exactly why, we would want a supervisor placed somewhere in the northern area. We don't know the exact town, but we know the reservations. There are 7. They would all get coverage, the 7 northern tribes. And you are correct, the 2, Prairie Island and Shakopee, are very supportive of this, but are not requesting funds for obvious reasons. So that is exact. We want all of the northern tribes covered. Would that be 0.5 or more than 1 FTE? That is the issue we're working on right now.
Commissioner, where does Morton and Granite Falls fall in?
We are reaching out, and there's a good question. They have, that's Upper and Lower Sioux. They have a relatively small population.
Would that be 0.5 to be shared between the two? Same. You know, one, those are exactly the kind of equipment. But they are in the mix.
If this comes forward, I guess we'd appreciate an update perhaps next year on where these locations ended up, where we're at, so we can track it too and talk about it when we're out and about rural Minnesota this year with folks.
Absolutely. I would also like to point out, as a matter of honor, present in the audience today is one of the seven hereditary chiefs from the Red Lake Band. Jim Loud is here. He's a Vietnam veteran.
Welcome.
But he is, as I say, one of seven hereditary chiefs. So it's a
If anyone over there wants a cup of coffee, it's over here. It's getting cold. So you just help yourself or raise your hand, and the pages will bring you a warm cup of coffee if you want it there, too. So that's there for you.
Thank you.
All right. Very good. Proceed.
Next, we are addressing the issue of the homeless veteran, which is, I think those two words together are very hard for people to say, and that's homeless veterans. And that shouldn't be, but it is. It's a very major issue. We have, several years ago, I don't remember the exact year, I would say probably in the 80s, something like that, there's a lot of discussion about doing something for homeless veterans. An organization called Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans was formed back right around the beginning of the 90s. And we have, over the years, we, as well as several other organizations, have chosen to do outreach to homeless veterans through their organizations. Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, or MACV, as the acronym is, it's a 501c3. It's been helping veterans and their families for over 14 years. More than 3,000 homeless veterans have been assisted with traditional housing or other services, which we'll get to in a minute. And MACV has been, they are known nationally in the area of homelessness. They are, their leaders have been recognized nationally for their model. And what they do, they provide, in the next slide, it sort of summarizes, they provide immediate, clean, off-the-street housing. They also, then they get involved with existing agencies. Let me just, rather than just read you the slides, let me just summarize. They then will, they are very well connected in the veterans community, the VA hospitals, private treatment places. They're very well connected, so they, if the appropriate problems are dealt with, whether they're physical, mental, chemical dependency, or whatever, they are dealt with. They are there then to pick the veteran up and proceed. If the veteran, the veteran needs to continue to be clean, but they will then move in finding employment, finding permanent housing, and they will follow a veteran all the way to back reintegration into society. And they have an outstanding track record. Here's the problem. They have, they're a 501c3, so they fundraise. And so their ability to, their numbers of people that they help is kind of like the sine curve. I mean, when they have funding, they can help. When they don't have funding, they don't help as many. Last year, they turned away, how many? 700 veterans were turned away last year because of not having funding at a given time. So their funding stream goes like this. And we as a department have given them an amount since their inception. Rather than reinvent the wheel, we're supposed to be involved with homelessness, and there is an existing program that does it very well. So we have been providing some ongoing assistance, but not nearly enough for them to function.
Is that a spokesperson from the group? Could we have her come up?
And yes, absolutely. This is Kathy Vitale. She's the Executive Director for Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans. And what we are requesting, our change item, before she starts talking, we are talking here $1 million a year or $2 million for the biennium for operations.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and spell your last name for our staff, and then I got a couple questions for you.
Sure. Kathleen Vitalis, V-I-T-A-L-I-S, Executive Director for Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans.
Just give us a little background on your council. Again, this is a new budget item for this committee this year.
Sure.
And talk to us about your group. Commissioner talked about you were formed in the early 90s and been serving Minnesota veterans community since then. Is it only housing? Do you do other things? How many employees do you have? Areas you cover in the state? Just give us a general outline of your group, will you?
Sure. I have 12 full-time employees, and we were started over 14 years ago with a program in Minneapolis. 9 years ago, we opened an office in Duluth. 6 years ago, we opened an office in Mankato. What I do like to point out is that even though we have those offices in Hennepin, St. Louis, and Blue Earth, 42 counties referred veterans to us last year. We are statewide. That is just where our offices are located. We had over 9,500 contacts from veterans last year, 450 of which became our clients, meaning that we spent some sort of money on them. My funding structure is such that I have, because I am a nonprofit, I can, as the commissioner said, fundraise. I get some federal grants. I have a Department of Labor grant for employment in the metro area. With every grant, of course, comes a specific set of guidelines. But our organization focuses on, we don't duplicate any other services that are already out there. Our success and the reason we're looked at as a national model is because we are statewide and because we don't duplicate someone else's services. We work in conjunction with all the county veteran service officers. We also focus on housing, employment, and legal assistance. And we do more intensive case management. We have more accountability for those veterans. We do prevention work as well, but a homeless situation or someone who is homeless, bringing them from that situation all the way through, as the commissioner said, back reintegrated into society, is not something you do in a month. And you don't get them a job right away. You have to get them connected to their health care, to their mental health care, very first step while they're in secure, clean housing. When they're ready, you start on work therapy programs. You reintegrate them slowly. We can work in our own transitional housing, some things like that, then to a full-time job and employment. We do some prevention work with crisis. Veterans will call a lot in the rural areas and outstate. I've lost my job. I can't pay my mortgage this month. I need some help. The Stakeholders Assistance Program you heard about, it's like they can help with those one-time crises. We can provide, if it's a more complicated matter, if it's going to go longer than a month, that's where we can step in with our more intensive case management and see them through with the variety of things that they're dealing with. So we work in conjunction with that.
Where do you just talk a little bit about the housing issue? Well, first of all, have you had requests like this to the state in the past, or is this the first time we've come with a $2 million per year request? Is that something new this year with the state, or since the 90s have we periodically given you money? Either of you.
Chair Junkie.
Any of you.
Chair Junkie, this is the first time that, well, I guess we have come forward with operational requests. I mentioned earlier our state has given some money in the past rather than we're supposed to spend something on homelessness through our SSSAD funds, so rather than reinvent the wheel. We work closely with them over the years. They have also, as she said, worked with several other agencies, federal, private, and but they have to fundraise.
And Ms. Vitalis, Are you having trouble with federal funding or other things, or is there just an increased caseload and you will continue to have equal resources from nonprofits, federal and other things, or is the federal funding kind of drying up, or what's the reasoning behind the $2 million request this year?
We can't meet the need that's there. And it's not that the federal is, I have about 75 separate grant programs that I follow. So if there is a federal program I can go after, I do. And like I said, the Department of Labor, we have some money. I have a VA grant and per diem for a 13-bed residential facility as a federal program. And so I think if it's available, we've accessed it, and the need is still there. And certainly with what we're seeing with some of the returning service personnel, we are, as I am often asked, in dealing with the homeless and prevention, yes, we have Afghanistan and Iraqi service personnel that are homeless, and we have been serving, and it is increasing. So there is that aspect of it as well.
How do we service, I'm a little curious on the housing particularly, and then I'll have a question on mental health, but housing, if someone calls from Twin Lakes or Appleton, Minnesota, or any more secluded rural area,
mm-hmm.
how do we address homeless vets out in those areas? Because frankly, I know even in Wilmer, a regional center, we don't have housing available for homeless folks other than a voucher to go to a hotel.
Right.
That's all we have out there. We don't have any shelters like the Twin Cities. We don't have any. How do you go about addressing that in rural areas of the state?
We work very closely with the county veteran service officer in that county, and you're absolutely right. There aren't shelters. There aren't things like that. So we will work to get that individual into housing by maybe a first, look for available housing, so pay first month's rent and the damage deposit, work with them on, but the continued plan, are they employable? Before you do that, you have to ascertain what is their situation. Are they homeless because they have a mental health issue that we need to help them get identified and dealt with? If that's the case, then we connect them through whatever is available with where you're, with where that veteran is at, to get that taken care of. But while we're doing that, we can get them into, and in that case, it would be market rate housing that's in that area. But we also have, in the Twin Cities, we own 8 of our own houses we use as transitional housing. We have one in St. Cloud, and that model we would like to continue with some of this additional funding we're looking at. I mean, and I know you're from across the state, so if I don't name your city, but Brainerd, Bemidji, Rochester, you start looking at how can we take the model that we have of a transitional home for homeless veterans, and what community can we go to next that needs that supportive service, and look at doing that to actually bring more housing directly into other communities.
Do you work with surrounding states, Grand Forks, Moorhead, Fargo, other larger cities that are bordering our rural areas? Are you in contact with resources there for mental health or housing or other things for folks up in Olin's district and others? How do we help folks in northwest Minnesota that are, a long ways away from the metro areas in Minnesota, even Duluth or... do we go across the state to Grand Forks or Fargo, or where do we go with these folks?
Well, and I think your question, sir, focused more on like the mental health, is that my organization would be a referral source for, mental health, and we would work in those outstate areas with the county veterans service officer on what is available there, but we would work with them on making sure they get what they need as that first step to get them connected in to appointments.
And is that mainly what you do then is probably phone work with county service officers? You said you had offices in Duluth, the cities in Mankato. These aren't necessarily drop-in offices for veterans. It's just where you're housed and your people typically
Correct.
Work.
Correct. And we can outreach. We will go to offices that need us to come there to meet with veterans. I have a HUD grant. I have a lot of grants. I have one HUD grant that is for rural northern Minnesota, and it helps. I have a case manager that is continually on the road that helps up to six families that have a disability that are outside of St. Louis County that are veterans. And so she does a lot of traveling and also will go to some of the other offices as we need. But that would be one of the areas. I have 12 staff. It's a big state. We do as much as we can, but in looking at increasing outreach, certainly, and I would have to think too, but another position that would be a traveling position to support those counties. A lot of times you need someone there a day a week or a day a month to meet with people, not full time at first. So that's what we're looking to do, to try to get more outreach into the counties.
And again, just so I'm just looking at overlap, and I'll use my area because I'm familiar with it. Why would a county service officer call you as opposed to Heartland Community Action in Willmar that does the exact same thing with the general population, that looks for housing, puts people into mental health treatment areas if they need it, identifies problems, and every part of the state has these community action agencies that do this. Why are they calling you instead of those folks?
In general, I can tell you that we certainly want to call them first. You want to use what's available already in your community first. But I will take one example. A single male adult veteran, not the one with a family, you will often find, if you're looking at different pools of money or generalist, a lot of different things, is that that's the group that's hardest to reach or that there's the least amount of funds for. And so the other reason, then they would call us. They call us when there isn't anything available. They're knocking on these doors and there isn't anybody who currently has any funding that can assist. And also because we exclusively help veterans. We are the only statewide nonprofit where our target is veterans. So we understand also a lot of the benefits that another a community agency that deals with the general population may not know what this veteran has as benefits that we can help them with the CVSO get them connected to.
Okay. All right, Representative Otremba.
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to maybe clarify it. You're 501c3.
Yes.
So you only do fundraising and grants, correct?
Yes.
So that's what I wanted to know. Just kind of lay it out that we don't. That's the only money you get, and so that.
Absolutely. Yes.
Probably a little difficult to budget.
Yeah. If. Yes, Representative. If I might also add, what gets very difficult, as he said, the Commissioner, the sine wave. As we outreach to counties, and 1 month we'll have funding, so the County Veterans Service Officer from Goodhue will call and say, you helped 3 months ago, I have an identical situation, can we help this person too? I'm sorry, I can't. It just puts the stop on everything. And then to get that county to call you back when you've had to say no once, it's really difficult. And so we're looking for more consistency.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chairman Junkie, and to Ms. Vitalis. Can you give me numbers or just a broad example of your past work? How many veterans have you prevented from becoming homeless? How many veterans have you actually were homeless and then you actually helped gain stable employment and move into an independent lifestyle? And then finally, another question follow up with that is, can you give us an idea from Afghanistan, the veterans that are returning, how many veterans are on the verge of becoming homeless? From the previous Gulf War incident, how many are on the verge of becoming homeless or are homeless? And then also the soldiers that are currently returning home, how many of the currently returned soldiers are on the verge of becoming homeless or are homeless? Do you have any of those numbers that you could give us an idea so it would help us see that need?
Ms. Patel.
Yes, Representative. I will only give you what I absolutely remember to be true, and then I may have to get some follow-up numbers for you. as far as our numbers, we've helped in the 14 years. And when I say over 3,500, we've had contacts last year alone, 9,500. So the 3,500 actually got some direct funding from us, 450 last year. As far as other numbers of what are we seeing, every day I'm getting a call from NPR, I'm getting a call from someone, you see what's happening nationally, you see it all over, and the headlines just had something in Newsweek the other day about, you know, Iraqi veterans that are homeless. It is happening. Why is it? We saw that became our clients, and I have to be careful because numbers are a dozen last year. We had contacts from many, many more that we were able to refer, I think, before a situation became to the point of homelessness. Why? And that's with this current war and these percentages, and I read many different ones, but if you can generally say that a third of the returning service personnel are seeking out some sort of mental health support. Now, that's a very general statement, but there are issues. We don't know yet what we're going to see, but we're already seeing it. And it is easy to understand I will talk about one case, because I think it's difficult for people to understand how someone who's been deployed for 18 months, within 8 months of coming back, is homeless. And it's in this particular case, they turned their power of attorney over to their parents. Young gentleman in his 20s, went off, came back, parents had spent his money. Argument ensued. It happens. He doesn't have any of the money that had been saved. He got his security job back, but he became angry, and he was dealing with PTSD and a lot of other issues, and we since then found out a traumatic brain injury. He got a DUI. He lost his security job. It just starts happening, and all of a sudden, he's homeless, living not necessarily on the streets. Homeless is friend to friend, to family. I can't afford. And because of his mental health issues, it just gets so complicated and starts imploding. And so it happens. And it will continue to happen. We'd like to try to come in with some of the prevention stuff. We're working with the Department of Veterans Affairs, with the Military Affairs. I'm on the Governor's Task Force, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon. We're all working together to ensure that this group has access, as much access as possible, to a variety of venues of how to get help.
Representative Will.
Thank you, Chairman Junkie. To Ms. Vitalis, just as a comment, if we appropriate the funding that you're requesting, and I think that there definitely is a need out there and you make the case for that, one thing I would like to see, though, for accountability is actual numbers of the people that you will serve in the future. And it would be, I think, good for us to see what the need is out there from the returning soldiers, the current cases that you are taking on, so that we can anticipate then the future need as well. So that's just my comment. Thank you for your comments. I appreciate that. But I would like to see some numbers in the future.
And I do concur with Representative Welty. I think there's a lot of unknowns right now with the population we will have returning here late summer, fall. Do mental health problems, you say possibly a fourth or a third of folks coming back will have some kind of stress or mental health issue at some time. Is that an immediate issue they have when they return in the first few months, or can that be something that might show up a year, 2 years, 5 years, or more down the line? Do we have an idea on that as we try and plan for treatment and services for these folks? How long out are we looking for these populations and caseloads to start increasing, particularly with mental health issues?
Chair Trunke, I would like to speak to that. My background is in claims, helping veterans. So is our Deputy Commissioner Mike Puglisi. We both came from that area. We were dealing with initial claims for post-traumatic stress disorder for World War II veterans when they were in their 70s, finally being retired completely for the first time. I was a combat veteran, got out of Vietnam and the service at one time, and I think I alluded to it at one hearing early on. In the first few months, if anyone had suggested that I should seek any kind of help, I would have taken strong exception to that. So problems can develop immediately or take many, many years, and there just is no way to know. It can be the whole range. If they're willing to seek or recognize and seek help, help is available now like never before. But will they?
All right. Very good. Thank you for joining us, and we'll ask you to continue.
Chair Junkie, I just wanted to point out that the houses you mentioned about, here is an example. They work with the Minneapolis VA Loan Guarantee Center, and they got how many houses for, it was like six houses for $1 a piece that were being repossessed by the VA. So that's some of the kind of work they've done
sure.
in the past.
Good.
Moving on, the last part of communication and outreach is $250,000. That deals with things like a 1-800 line. Last year, we got funding for a website, one-stop shopping website, which is up and running. 1-800 vet help line would be, this is a benefits hotline now, not a crisis line. That's a completely different thing. But anyway, this would be a benefits line. We want to actually start outreach. Representative Hamilton, way back at the beginning, you know, you asked that very question. We want to get out with public service announcements, ads, get the word out. That's exactly what we want to do. And I know that the counties are doing that also, but right now there is such a need to get the word out. So that's exactly what part of this.
Commissioner, is this a line that your staff will be answering?
Yes.
It comes into your office, live person on the phone?
Yes. Yes, Chair.
Okay.
Yes.
And I will, heads up, I know there's some bills coming addressing not only this, but also more of the crisis hotline services, too, and we'll be talking about that in the next couple of weeks with some bills also. So hopefully we can work together on some solutions mm-hmm. to that. All right.
Then we move to the higher education veterans assistance offices on campus. This was a new program last year, which it's on page 22 of your budget sheets. And I'll speed things up here. We opened up, we currently have six FTEs, five full-time, two part-time. We have 32 centers in operation. 27 centers were created since August of 2006. We contracted with MNSCU for the services of Don Pfeffer, who is in the audience here somewhere. Yes, there he is. He is a senior faculty member within MNSCU and had taken time off and had opened campus center at Brainerd Lakes on his own during a sabbatical. And we contracted for his services, and then we hired the outreach people. They are located Mankato, Moorhead, Marshall, St. Cloud, Duluth, and Minneapolis. And so we have them spaced all around the state. We have to report every January 15th to the legislature. The first report says that we had 1,700 individual contacts, unique contacts. In other words, several would have more than one. This is just a very successful program. We are looking for $1.8 million in ongoing funds from the general fund and $500,000 one-time money.
Give me the name of those cities again. Mankato, Moorhead, Marshall.
Currently, Mankato, Marshall, Moorhead, St. Cloud, Duluth, and Minneapolis. But each one of the reps, they're known as campus reps for short, and each one of the reps is charged with outreaching to the schools in their areas, private schools, the public schools, tech schools, whatever. So this, the language that created this last year, it sunsetted, it views, it comes up anytime there would be less than 4,000 veterans going to school in the state, or 2011, whichever triggers it first, it's up for review. So this is not, this is not foreseen as a program forever.
So Commissioner was put in as a 2-year program or beyond that?
Well, beyond that, but with the year, the first sort of thorough review is, I think, 2011. But it's also if the number of students drops below a certain level, and I'm pretty sure it's 4,000 students, it is triggered for review at that point also.
As we review this and talk about it and think about it, again, adding another 12 additional spots, number one, we need to understand where those are proposed to be. And number two, what's the advantage or what's the, why would we not just, especially in some of our more rural counties and smaller schools, working rather more closely with our county service officers and the current financial aid and counselors that are at some of these colleges, training, assisting, setting up regular schedules at the colleges, etc. Why the need for an additional 12? The regional people aren't able to get to the campuses on a timely basis, or again, county service officers, others, as far as benefits, couldn't they cooperate there too? I'm just trying to discover the reasoning behind additional.
Chair Junkie, in many counties that is the case. There are in a small county, the county service officer is already contacting, but you would be surprised how. Well, wait a minute. Before I get to that point, I just want a fact which has been given before is 30% of veterans drop out in the first semester when they go back to school. It's very difficult for returning veterans to easily assimilate back into school. One of the main missions is to have sort of peer-to-peer contact, just someone who can. But oftentimes the initial contact point is just talking, and then a second initial contact point is someone at the schools who can help them with the red tape of applying for benefits. Now, and I don't mean to find fault with the financial offices, but very often, I mean, they veterans benefits is just one little part of their job. So very oftentimes they are confused by why a check is not coming or the red tape involved. The county service officers, now it's a matter of scale again. If you are talking about a very small school in a relatively small county, the service officer is very much involved. But it would involve setting up a spot physically on the campus, and there's not really that much ability to do that. And the campus reps actually have spots on the campuses, and they're known. Even though we have very few now, they try to get out to other campuses. That would increase the numbers there. This is getting ready for the 3,000 veterans that are coming back. Now they will. What is it? July now. It's the latest, and a large number of them will be going back to school soon. And so there is one-time money involved in this also.
Do we have an idea on the schools they left or that they're returning to? I would assume we do. Would Jess Minsky and others keep those numbers? They know veterans populations within their ranks or that are receiving veterans benefits,
yes,
et cetera. So we can, I guess I'm trying to understand how we're going to pinpoint where these 12 folks go. And it must be based on numbers like that or experience of the past somehow.
Chair Junkie, and I will have Don speak specifically, but there's two or three points. Minsky knows the number of veterans if they self-report as such. They also know that a lot of veterans have not applied for benefits. They know that. Also, the guard knows where. You've seen those. I think the general refers to them as measles maps. It shows where the people, the dots are on the state where they're coming back. We put that all together, and Don Pfeffer will talk. We do have ideas of where these reps will be located, and I will have Don talk.
Welcome. Introduce yourself for us.
Don Pfeffer, Director of Higher Education Veterans Programs. Thank you for inviting me to address you, Chairman. What we're looking at for additional sites, in addition in the northeast, northwest region, in addition to Moorhead, we'll be looking at Detroit Lakes and Bemidji. If we go up to the northeast, we're looking at Hibbing and Virginia area, potentially two people. In the central region, we're looking at Brainerd and Alexandria, in addition to the St. Cloud, where we're at now. In the metro, we're looking at four additional spots spread out equally distributed as best we can across the metro area, and specific campuses haven't been identified yet. In the southwest, we're looking at, in addition to Marshall, we're looking at Worthington. And in the southeast, we're looking at Rochester and Monona for additional sites. I need to go back and talk a little bit philosophically about the veteran centers that we established. These veteran centers are actually the responsibility of the campus that we're helping to assist. It's their job to provide the veteran center. So we go in, and our regional people go in to help them design that, adopt the philosophy, get the campus behind it, attempt to find resources. The campus itself is responsible for the space, for the fixtures, for the operations, and we will assist them in finding staffing. Primarily, we staff them on the local level with federal work-study positions and some local work-study positions, as well as community volunteers. We have several campuses who step forward and actually place employees within the veteran centers to work. What we see, the veterans have a significant amount of issues, and many of them have been discussed as we've come up to this point. We see the mental health issues, we see the homelessness issues, we see the whole array of issues beyond just education funding. That's a very, while it's a major part, it's not the only part. The number one reason for, up to this date, we have served just slightly shy of 2,000 individuals. The number one reason they come to the veteran centers is for conversation and talking. And we thought benefits would be the number one. The number three reason for coming in is benefits. So these veterans, and we have a wide range of veterans, young veterans, old veterans, they come in, they want to connect. And we can spend the time with them in our veteran centers, either through the workers we've got there, our regional person who goes there, or other employees of the college who do work or and help staff those veteran centers. So we work closely with the county veteran service officers, but again, they're busy. Education is a very narrow specialty within the veteran services. It's a very complex issue, as a matter of fact, and we constantly have to advocate and work with veterans to track down where they're at, what's going on, why are things late, what's the emergency process we can put in place to help you stay in school while your veterans funds come in. It goes on and on and on. So that's the work that is done through the veteran centers. We are understaffed. We need more people on more campuses, and the campuses are asking for that.
And Mr. Pfeffer, campuses are asking for, why wouldn't they be employing and doing this rather than Mr. Commissioner Dyrud and his department?
Well, what they're asking for is the help to get their campus going. And if they can identify an employee or figure out through their budget to staff it, they're trying to do that. A lot of the outstate campuses don't have the money. They don't have the resources to specifically staff a veteran center.
Could you give us a map of the current locations and then the proposed locations on a Minnesota map? I think it'd be helpful to get the committee as we look at this too. I'm a visual guy. I got to see dots.
Yes, sir. That's
so awesome. The commissioner said. It'd be nice to get that. If you could get a copy of that measles map too,
yeah,
that would be helpful on our returning folks from the National Guard here in the next few months. I think that would be helpful for us to see too as we're putting some of this together. Questions? Comments? I'll let you finish this section. Can you come back for 15, 20 minutes beginning tomorrow and finish up? Because we're almost near the end of our time here.
Yes, Chair.
We'll give you the first 15, 20 minutes. We didn't quite get through everything, and I want to make sure we take the time we need to hear everything you have to say. So tomorrow we'll give you the first part of the
Thank you very much.
Finish up with whatever you have on the higher ed here, and then we'll move along.
Chair Junkie, I just wanted to point out that the special project, the one-time funding, of great interest, I think, to me personally, it's just it sounds very kind of exciting, is it's the online portion of it, where soldiers can actually go online from Iraq or wherever they are and start the process. Technically, they can sort of do that, but this is making it easy, one place to help them get started in that whole process. To ease the way, and I think that's a very exciting part of this, of the one-time funding. But I think, like I said, we've covered the points, so, you know, other than just reading the slides to you, which I, you know, sure won't do, but that is, again, we will get them by tomorrow, we will get the maps that show current and future locations, and the measles map for the whole state.
All right, well, we'll pick up there tomorrow, members. We'll finish the Veterans Affairs presentation. If there's any other questions on what we've already covered, we'll do that. We'll have some continued overviews from the Ag Department tomorrow, and we will take up the Ag Special Bill of Welties and get that over to Higher Ed Committee. So all that to come tomorrow. With that, we're adjourned.